Any therapist in the group that would be willing to stand up so that the rest of you could see that there are people here who do counseling, do therapy, and they're here. And to me, that's one of the best things I could say about somebody, is that they're helping other people, but they're also working on themselves. So would any therapists care to stand up, or counselors? Just raise your hand. Okay, stand up, look around. Go ahead, come on, Mary. and the rest of you can notice these people, and if you want to talk to one of them at the end, I think it's a very neat thing to see how many counselors and therapists are working on their own lives. And for all of us who do this work, if we're not working on ourselves, it's pretty hard to help others, especially if you're codependent, because you're just going to be enhancing your codependency. Now, the thing that I wanted you to experience is that you probably have been set up in some kind of role, and that or the feeling of that role goes with you all your life. You can be exactly in it 30 years later. The role is one way to help you get to your feelings. By breaking out of the role, you break out of the system. Because remember, the function of the role is to keep the system going. Why do we do the role? Why do you get in the role? Because the system needs this homeostasis. It needs this balance. But the fact is that the dysfunctional roles don't work. My being a hero hasn't saved my brother, sister, my dad, or my mother. My being a caretaker has not worked with any of them. And so the roles don't work. They're dysfunctional roles. And one of the ways to give them up is to begin to realize what feelings did the role demand that you have. What that means is somebody just walked up to you and gave you a script and said, here, play this part in the play. And so when you play this part in the play, you have to have feelings that go with that part, right? And so after 40 years of playing the role, or 20 years of playing the role, or 15 years of playing the role, you don't even know you're playing a role anymore. You think that's what you really feel. And so one of the things about getting in touch with the family system roles is that they are a way to help you get to your feelings about the role, and the feelings that you had to give up to have the role. Now, one of the ways out of the role is to express the feelings that you had to give up, to start expressing them. For me to be vulnerable and sad and hurt and need help is a way to stop being a hero all the time. To be willing in a context of my life not to be on stage, not to be the hero. That's a way to start giving up the role. The feeling of the role will stay with you, but you can give up the role, and you can change the role into a healthier way of being. I don't mind, you know, being a leader. As I deal with my shame, I can handle that more and more. That some of us are called to verbalize things as part of this movement. I know that in AA for years people would say, well, you can say it, you know, you can say those things, that's what I felt, but I've never been able to say it. And I had to grapple with that, but I'm happy. That's paying my dues. As long as I don't start thinking I'm exceptional in some way and that I don't have the problem anymore. That's the danger of getting in the leadership role or the guru role or whatever that is. That's the danger of it. And I don't want, you know, I've got to fight not to let that happen, because there's a part of me that likes the ego fanfare and all of that. I don't want to be the hero in my family. I want to be a daddy. I want to love my kids. I don't expect them to, you know, my son's not at all impressed with a lot of my stuff. And I get it, that's okay. I'm his dad. I'm not the leader or blup blup or the lecturer. I'm his dad. And It's real important. I'm not a caretaker anymore. I'm a caregiver. And there's context in my life where I'm perfectly willing to give care, but I don't have to. And there are times when I will refuse. I've got 150 people on a waiting list, and I don't worry about it anymore. I used to just grapple with that all the time. I'm moving out of counseling now. It's hard, hard, hard work. And I feel like my energy is better used like this. And, you know, and people want me to continue to counsel. And there's my codependency wants them to like me. And but I can give better care like this. And I can give care and not be a caretaker. Or not be super responsible, not try to be responsible for everybody. Building boundaries, knowing where I end and you begin, not taking on other people's problems when I really need to take care of my own. Those are all the ways that I can work out of this system. And the more I work out of those roles, the more I leave that family. Do you all see that? That the more you give up the role, the more you leave the dysfunction. You get back in touch with your own feelings. You start getting connected with yourself. And then the more you give up those roles and leave that system, the more you're giving up the codependency. And see, that's basically what we've been working on today, is how do you treat codependency? Well, if I can break out of the system wherein I became codependent, then I am dealing with my codependency. And if codependency is not knowing what I feel, not knowing what I need, not knowing what I want, then stopping taking care of everybody else and starting getting in touch with what I feel, what I need, what I want, that's a way to work out of the codependency. So this is part of the process. Now, it's not all of the process, and there are other ways to do this. There are other ways to do family of origin work. Some of you have done it in therapy. There's other therapeutic approaches to it. I just wanted to give you a sample of a way to do it. And it's a good way. We do this in our family, our Center for Recovering Families. We have a 4.5-day workshop where people work on in 5 hours a day in groups, you work on your family system. And you work on what we call the original pain. Original pain work. See, in some ways, until you go back and express the feelings, you stay in delusion and denial. And the more I can express the feelings, then I don't have to act them out anymore. The more I can express the feelings. And this is also shame reduction work. Because what you're really saying, it's okay for me to feel angry being set up to be my mother's surrogate spouse or my dad's little princess. And that's cost me, it's had life-damaging consequences. It's cost me a great deal, and I have a right to be angry about that. And I have a right to express anger toward that parent. We take bataka sticks and we put a chair there and we put the parent over here. We don't hit the parent with bataka sticks, even in symbolism. But we hit the chair and say, "I'm angry at you," and express the anger. See, you couldn't do that as little kids. Who could you have talked to? Who would have listened to you? So where did all that energy go? It just went in there. Or those of you who got set up with incest or sexual abuse, you've had to carry that secret for years. Because you were in this terrible paradox that if you expressed what happened to you, you lost your family. I mean, what a terrible paradox. What a terrible double bind. And incest is all about this. In violent families, you don't dare open your mouth. You're terrified. You get beat up. And then what happens is the victims out of violence often become offenders themselves. Because what victims will do is they'll identify with their violator because their violator was powerful. So victims will literally become offenders because the offender was powerful. And they just simply, it's the only way they can have a reality, is identify with that offender. So this is a journey, and we've got to heal that past. Now, another part of the work is the inner child work. And I'm going to do a tiny exercise with you as the last exercise of today, of sort of going back and touching that little child. Maybe when I come back, what we can do is the inner child workshop, which is a day and a half type workshop where we go through all the developmental stages. We put people in groups, and you sit in the group and you hear the kinds of words that you needed to hear as a child, like your infancy needs. You close your eyes and you have people touch you and say, "Welcome to the world. I'm glad you're here." Huh? Huh? What'd you say? When are we going to do that? I don't know yet, but we're going to. But you see, those infancy needs, you needed to hear somebody that was happy you were here. And welcome to the world. And you'll have all the time you need to get your needs met. And I want to be close to you. And I want to love you. And I want to touch you. See, some of you already start feeling sad, don't you? The second you hear those words. If you're a lost child, first time I did this, I had 8 of my own clients who were all lost kids. In 2 seconds, they were abdominally crying. Because I'm going to tell you, if you didn't hear those words, you've got a hole in your soul. And you grew up without those needs met. And every time you walk in a new situation in your life, those infancy needs come up. See, because those things are recycled. Pam Levin wrote a real powerful book called The Cycles of Power. And she talks about how those needs are recycled through your life. So in my workshop, we go through every developmental stage and have people in groups. I do some of it in hypnotic age regression, and I say the words. We do some of it in groups where you hear the words. At a certain point, you write a letter to your parents, and then you read it to your group. And boy, you may think you know how to dissociate, but when you get in that exercise, I have seen the toughest people go right into the feelings. And of course, there's a tremendous healing because we're all there together and we're all acknowledging that we need help. And it is indeed the most powerful single workshop I've ever been involved in. I've never seen anything like it. And the healing that comes out of it. I was in Dallas 2 days ago. 3 people came up to me and said, "Changed my life." Because you see, once I can touch that energy again and embrace that child, it's as if I said, "Here's a child, take them home with you now and pay some attention to them. It won't take much. You don't have to feed them or clothe them anymore. But just be aware there's a part of you that's tiny and vulnerable and scared and that never got to be that way. You had to pretend you weren't." And I keep a picture of a 4-year-old on my desk. People say, "Is that your son?" I say, "No, it's me." You know, and it's kind of weird sometimes. And I keep a picture of my wife as a 4-year-old, and when I start getting angry at her and I know all about her life and her childhood, it's very healing to look at that picture. And I get it, you know, that little girl that was kind of abandoned was sent off to summer camps at 5 years old because mama was bombing around Europe, and who was just literally orphaned, even though her family had some wealth. You know, I grew up poor thinking, boy, if you have money, you could never suffer. And had terrible prejudice against anybody who had money. But that's not true. People have as much pain with money as without money. But anyway, those are 2 kinds of things. Then in second level recovery, we do a lot of maintenance work, confronting the inner voices. Robert Firestone has these whole techniques where he has people get the inner voices out and exaggerate them. Like, what are you saying to yourself? And it's just amazing when people get onto this because a lot of it goes on unconsciously. How you shame yourself and how you beat yourself and you put yourself down and you carry those internal tapes TA people talk about your parent tapes, your critical parent tapes, the introjected voices, and it's not just from mom and dad. It could be from school teachers, or it could be from anybody who criticized you. But see, we will tend to shame ourselves the way we were shamed. So we have to learn how to stop those internal cycles. Then another thing I have people do is write affirmations. And this is a very helpful kind of exercise. Like, in writing this book recently, I've been trying to write a book for 15 years. I've had advances from publishers, and I've never written a book. And so one of the things I did about 2 years ago is I started writing affirmations. I, John, am perfectly capable of writing an adequate book. And you write that 20 times, same sentence over and over again, ideally twice a day, and then you draw a line down the center column, and over here you put reply. See, a lot of people do affirmations, but they don't do the reply column. And then what you do is you write the affirmation and wait for the first voice that comes to you. And mine will be, this is BS, this isn't going to work, this is too simple, how could this possibly change a lifetime of complexity? These are my voices. And see, what they're doing is they're stoppers. They're going to stop you from being creative. They're going to stop you. Because you see, a lot of times, as tragic as this is, it isn't the conscious part of mom or dad, but it's the unconscious, what the TA people call the child in mama or the child in daddy, who doesn't want you to succeed. They're too jealous. Even could want you dead. Firestone found over and over again in the voices of people that there was a part of that mother that wanted to get lost. And so you wonder why you have suicidal feelings, or why you have a lifestyle that's really a death style. It's no lifestyle at all. It doesn't bring you life. And so it's real important to boy, when you get that calm, you do this for 3 weeks. Write these affirmations for 3 weeks. And man, I'm telling you, that right-hand column, sometimes you won't believe the stuff you're saying to yourself. Because a lot of it functions unconsciously. So it's another way to deal with the voices in your head that keep you from leaving that system and keep you from getting to your own power. Then I believe in things like assertiveness training and communication training, self-image thinking, all that kind of thing can be really helpful if you've done some of this original pain work. In other words, corrective experiences. But the original pain work is not a corrective experience. It's experiencing what you never experienced, that you're acting out. Does everybody understand that? It's like you never did express these feelings. You had to repress them to survive. So it's not, we're not talking about corrective. We're getting you to go back and do what you never did. See, if you don't work it out, you act it out. That's all you can do with that energy. Or you project it, or you act it in. But it's got to go somewhere because it's energy. And energy is about molecules and electrons. Emotion is energy. This is Freudian. This is very Freudian. Freud really discovered that energy is there in our emotional life. Then third level recovery. Now, to me, third level recovery is spiritual awakening. And there's a danger in doing the spiritual work too soon. Because believe me, I was into astral traveling. I was into a monastery meditating on Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross before I could hardly blow my nose. And I was doing all this heavy spiritual discipline, fasting, kneeling 6 hours without moving a muscle when I was studying to be a priest in the monastery. And all of it, for me, was basically an addiction. it was not because I still hadn't done the original pain work. I hadn't done the family of origin work. And what happens with it is you get into very subtle delusion and denial. It's like, I don't need to do any of this other stuff. I'm in higher consciousness now. And I see some people in higher consciousness that desperately need lower consciousness. You know, yes. I know it. Well, I tell you what, the way I think it goes, and that's a good point, that I wouldn't discourage somebody from meditating. I mean, again, if you're rigidly codependent, don't rush out of here and say, Bradshaw said I can't do this. Try meditating. See what happens to the quality of your life, to the quality of your relationships. I don't think that everybody has to go the same way by any means, and it may sound like it, but I don't believe that. And I believe there's grace, and I believe there's people that are unique, and I believe there are people that have had grace in their childhood. They had a teacher, they had an uncle, they had an aunt that broke them out of these systems, so that everybody doesn't have to sort of take it. I'm sort of giving you the survey. And that's the problem with it. And there are some spiritual masters who say that you can heal some of this stuff. I don't know about that. I sure tried it that way, and it didn't work for me. Now, I'm into daily meditation again. I'm into higher consciousness work. That's more important to me than anything in my life right now. I do dream work. I do some journaling. This is important kind of stuff for me. But I found that it's really going now, and when I was doing it back there at 22, it was almost like an athletic contest I was in. And it was very much competitive, and I was still into a lot of ego with it. And maybe those are some of the things. A lot of the spiritual masters say that if you have unfinished business in the ego, the energy will always draw you back to it. And that's one of the criteria. And it's like, Are you really clear from the past? And I'll tell you the way that you'll know. You can say unequivocally that your life is perfect. That my daddy was perfect. He was just the kind of daddy I needed in order to be here right now. That my mother was perfect. That the whole system was perfect. That I came into this world, my soul had a journey, my soul had a mission, and that all of that was part of it. But you don't do that until you've healed the ego. Because if you're an incest victim and you say you're in the Course of Miracles, and you say there's nothing to forgive, nothing really happened to me that was bad, I think that's terribly dangerous. If you go to Est and you do 2 weekends and they come out and they say, did you get it? Your dad's perfect, but you haven't done a lot of the work. That can be damaging. I'm not saying it always is. I'm just saying it can be. I've seen people damaged with it. I don't think it's bad. I think the stuff that's being preached is wonderful. But it's almost like there's one level of consciousness called ego, and there's another level called subconscious, and there's a larger level. It's almost like, it's not that you ever get rid of your ego, but the ego becomes an axis, and you've got to be able to cope, and you've got to have enough security, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got to have enough security in your deficiency needs or your dependency needs that's pretty well taken care of, so that now you can begin to let go. You're not terrified all the time. You're not shame-based, and you can begin to soar. You can begin to let go of ego. You can begin to let go of control. Your whole life's not around control and survival. Because I think to meditate well, you've got to know how to give up control. That's the whole point of focusing on the counting, is to get that ego distracted so you can get to that still, quiet place. And it's in that silence that there's another faculty available to us called enlightenment, intuition. And it's at that moment that you can know God directly. You can know the oneness of the universe directly. So it's not even like the difference between that and ego is like transformation. It's transpersonal. But there's a danger in going there too soon, in the sense that it can be a refuge, and it's very exciting, and it can lend itself to the kind of mood alteration that comes from addiction. Now, anybody who's really done a lot of meditating knows that it isn't all that mood altering. There's a lot of hard work in it. It's like water dripping on a rock. What I wanted was grandiose stuff in the beginning. You know, I wanted to have the experience of God instantly. And, you know, I wanted to turn the faucet on full and now take me into outer space. And, you know, I would get these powerful meditations like my inner guide would tell me to clean up your desk. That isn't what I wanted. What the point is, it's like ego has one point of view and that higher consciousness has another point of view. And from the higher consciousness point of view, your life is perfect. That it all makes sense when you see it in its totality. And Jackie Small says that there's some of us are evolving and some of us are revolving. And I don't know why some of us are evolving and some of us are evolving, but boy, it's clear to me that you can't even be at a thing like this unless there's some energy in you to evolve. And the folks that have no truck with this, as we look at their lives a lot of the time, are revolving. They're in a squirrel cage. It's deja vu. It's the same old thing over and over again. For the 100th time, it's the same fight over and over again. And so to begin to break out of that. So I really endorse the spiritual life and unitive consciousness and cosmic consciousness and moving into that arena of meditation and prayer and quiet and inner consciousness. And I'm making these safeguards. I don't think that you've recovered from codependency until you've had a spiritual awakening. Because it's an inner kingdom, not the outer kingdom. Yes. Well, I think the higher power is there at every stage, in the sense that in the beginning I used my higher power just like I always used God, kind of as a great big bear aspirin. You know, you get me out of this and I'll promise you I'll, you know, and knowing, you know, believing in a higher power in the beginning was really salvation for me, because I didn't trust people, but I could trust something greater than everybody. But for me, that wasn't the major way I came in, because I had all this theology and all this religiosity and all this spiritual discipline. I had to put all that in brackets. And actually, what happened to me is I began to see how powerfully the spiritual was working in people's lives, and how seriously they were taking it, because a part of me had so intellectualized it. And I was too young to be reading Teresa of Avila and the Unitive Way and that kind of stuff at 22 years old. For me, that's the way it went. For some of you, you may have come a whole different route, and that may be very powerful for you. I'm a Christian theologian, and Jesus Christ makes a lot of sense to me as a model of humanness, as one who forgave and didn't judge, and who told us about his Father, who was unconditionally accepting. That makes sense for me. He said that they may be one as I, Father, in thee. That it's unitive that he's pointing to. And forgiveness and total acceptance and how that gets botched up just terrifies me. But on the other hand, I think it's God as you understand her, him, them, whatever. And that's what's important. I resent it greatly that my journey to God was dictated to by Baltimore Catechism 1-12, and that really they stopped me from ever discovering. They were giving me the answers before I even knew the question. Paul's the experience of the holy, and to come to it on your own. Yes, sir. Well, what I've been describing, that's a great question, that really it is a forgiveness process. When I talk about the anger, see what Kubler-Ross and Erich Lindemann and all these people who have studied grieving and death and dying, because people who know they're dying are grieving for themselves. Kubler-Ross's stages of a dying person are actually the same stages Erich Lindemann found in 1944 when he did all that major study on grief. What he found is that they go through shock, you go through bargaining, you go through denial, you go through anger. So when I'm talking about the anger with the family of origin, I'm talking about part of a grief process. Then you come to hurt and sadness, and finally acceptance and forgiveness, to give as before. But once I'm out of that system, then I can go back and have a relationship with my mom. That's a much healthier relationship, which I do. And I held my dad on his deathbed. I talked to him about dying. I had done all these death and dying courses. I had no unfinished business with him. And so it's not at all to not forgive that family. But in the process, sometimes you have to get some distance. You have to make a judicious evaluation of how close you want to be. For some of you where you still have very abusive parents, that's where you may have to leave them to their fate. You have to make the decisions about that. But yes, it's very important to the whole point of that second level work is get that finished. A resentment is a re-feeling of old feelings and just going over and over and over and over, and you're in bondage to the past. When I teach resentment and forgiveness, I say, you're not hurting them with the resentment, you're hurting you. The resentment is like blocked energy. It's like a blood clot that you just keep going over. It's repetition compulsion. And so we want to forgive so we can give as before and heal the past. And that's what this process is. Second level work is a forgiveness process. That's what we're trying to do. Yes, ma'am. Creating a personal myth. Well, what I'd say to you is if that works for you, see, because I think it's all mythology in the sociological sense that we're always creating meanings. You know, the great insight of Est is that they really give us the epistemology. That is, that you can take any event and have a bunch of different meanings for it. In fact, that's the basis of a whole therapeutic technique called reframing. That you can look at the same event in two different ways. And if that offers you a kind of archetypal healing, then I'd go with that. And that is about unconditional love. It is about forgiveness. And if you're growing out of it, see, to me the criterion, love always means spiritual growth. What spiritual growth means for me is an energy that fuels your lifestyle. That is, it gives you more life through creativity, which is the godly virtue. That is, if you want to be like God, be creative. That God is the creator of heaven and earth. And we've had all this obedient stuff and had nothing about creativity over here. And certainly in this place, with the great artistic stuff that's going on here, T.S. Eliot said that all works of art are religious works, that's spiritual works. They touch eternity. What Baudelaire said, it's at once through poetry and art and music that the soul glimpses the splendors that are situated beyond the grave. When an exquisite song or poem, a work of art, brings tears to the eyes or chills down the back, it's not so much an excessive joy, but rather the testimony of an irritated melancholy, a demand of the nerves of a nature exiled in the imperfect, and demanding, even in this life, the revealed paradise. So I think the artwork is a beautiful example of godliness. So lifestyle... Sorry about that outburst, folks. lifestyle... Where'd that come from? Lifestyle is the fuel that gives us more life. A lifestyle means you have more life. You have more life and more creativity and expansion and growth and love. So to me, that's the criteria that I want to look at. And of course, sometimes you can't know. The thing I hate about all this evangelism and Jimmy Baker and Falwell and Oral Roberts is that that's all that extrinsic religion. Gordon Allport at Harvard did all that work on extrinsic religion, how extrinsically religious people were more bigoted, more prejudiced. Where's the inner life? Where's the kingdom that's within? The still, quiet voice. The private life, where many are called and few are chosen. Where the narrow gate that very few enter, because it's private. It's deep, it's profound, it isn't garish, it isn't making a lot of noise. It's that deep nourishment of the spirit. And it frightens me to see so much of the other, and so much fanfare and so much money being given to it. And, I don't know. Another question, yes, ma'am. Healthy families being able to fight. Yeah. Well, what I think is that it's so important, whether to send your son to religious school, and what was the other part of the question? Fighting fair. Well, I think giving standards is sort of my own inner standard. If I have standards, then I model that for children. Children are learning what you're doing. And the job of parents is to be models. And the more I model good boundaries, discipline, Scott Peck, it's delaying gratification, telling the truth at any cost, self-responsibility. Boy, if we were modeling that for our kids. See, we don't have to teach them a bunch of rules and regulations. Fighting fair. I'm an unrepeatable diamond in the rough. You're an unrepeatable diamond in the rough. What happens when these two unrepeatables clash? Which they inevitably will do, because we're utterly unique. And you're not always going to see it my way. I'm not going to see it your way. How do we fight fairly? And we're going to fight. You can't be intimate if you don't have the capacity for conflict. I have couples come in, 18-year marriage. The woman says, I've never been happy in this marriage. He says, what? Quit telling him that. Tell him you have been happy. Now, this woman's been lying to her husband for 17 years, pretending like she's happy when she's not. The capacity for conflict. Well, stay in the now. Be self-responsible. You're only an authority on what's under your skin. I feel real uncomfortable when you dance 5 times with Farquhar. It looks to me like you're attracted to him. I feel like I feel scared. I feel rejected. It taps my abandonment issues. Is there something we can do about that? Rather than, who do you think you are dancing with that young boy at your age and as fat as you've gotten? Second one is unfair fighting. First one is I'm just telling the truth. I'm telling you about what's going on in here. Or I'm confronting you with something that's bothering me. Stay in the now. Argue, you know, fight about what's happening. You know, you're late for dinner. Not you brought your mother to our condo at Padre Island, 1947. I'll never forget that. Don't fight about details. I'm 50, you're 15, I'm 14 minutes late. I just checked my watch. 13 and a half minutes late. See, all of that just gets us. And valuing, if I use I messages, I feel rejected when I see you staring at that guy. And I understand that you can be attracted to other people than me. However, when saliva's running down your mouth, it terrifies me. Could you talk to me about that? See, instead of, boy, you adulterer, name-calling, that's all all you get with that is fight and flight. Because it's threatening, it's attacking. Boy, it'll hook your shame in seconds. So fair fighting means that I stay within my own skin, I be clear about what I see and hear, what I interpret, what I feel, what I want, and use I messages in disclosing concrete, specific data. And I've learned to do that. I had no idea how to do any of this 15 years ago. And over the years, I've really learned how to do that. Nancy and I have big fights, and we resolve them. And we don't hurt each other anymore. We fight like banshees sometimes, but we don't hurt each other. And I think that, to me, I may not be right, but I think that's the journey. That you get to a place where, of course, you're going to have conflict, but you're no longer hurting each other. You're not trying to put each other down. Okay, we're running out of time. Let me ask you to do this. Just close your eyes again. I want to do one last thing. This is a part of the inner child work. And this time, just very quickly, go to that inner place. That inner place where you were, that room where you walked down the marble stairs. And you can do this meditation yourself, and you can take more time with it, or use your own style of meditating. But just go to that place now, that room that's a symbol of your inner self. It's a symbol of your center. And look around the room. Maybe it's changed this time, and that's okay. You can change it every time. It's a place deep within you where you and you alone can go. It's a place of power. And integration. And let yourself go back in time to that house you lived in, that little child that you were in touch with a moment ago, maybe even younger than second grade. Just imagine you could see him in the front yard of the house or walking out of the house. Call them over to you. Tell them that you're from their future. You may not see the child clearly, but that's okay. Just get a sense of that child. I'm from your future, and I know better than anyone in the world what you have been through. Your hurts and pain, your abuse, your abandonment. And if you feel like that you can do this, just a day at a time, tell them that you've come to get them, that you want to take them with you now, and that they don't have to play that role anymore to survive. They don't have to be a caretaker or a hero. They can just be a little child with you. That you'll put a picture of them in your purse or your wallet, You remember them maybe for about 5 minutes every day at the same time. Tell them that of all the people they'll ever know in their life, you're the only one they'll never lose or leave. And you may feel a lot of sadness when you say that, and that's okay. Just let that sadness come. Take a little child by the hand. Start walking down the street and look back and see your parents on the steps. Say goodbye to them. You can't cure this codependency until you do. Say goodbye to them. That'll feel real scary. Feel real scary. Start walking along. Maybe you need to pick them up, hold them in your arm, and as you look back, they get more and more distant, farther and farther away. You need to leave that home now to have your own life. And just imagine you could take that little child and put them in your heart. And just do it so that they're inside of you now and you know they're there. And promise yourself tomorrow at noon or 5 o'clock or right before you go to bed at night, when you get up in the morning, you'll just for 5 minutes make contact with that little child. Just get in touch with how they feel. And pay attention to them, their vulnerability. Put that picture of them in your purse or your wallet. And now just go back to your room and just be there. Just be there. Know that child's inside of you. And just open yourself up now to your God or your higher power, to the universe, whatever your way of unity is. Just open yourself up to that now. Let yourself feel one with this power, this higher power, this God, Jesus, the universe, that you're a part of everything. Everything is a part of you. And this little child lives in you. And you can love them and nurture them, take them home with you today. And just slowly now, you'll remember this. Just slowly open your eyes. Just slowly, slowly open your eyes. Okay, that's a very powerful kind of work to touch that child in you, as some of you realize doing it. And there's a lot more work we do with that, but you can do that every day. Just touch that part of you. Let yourself touch that part of you. And realize that no matter how old you get, what Walt Disney understood better than anybody is that while there's very little adult in a child, there's an enormous amount of child in every adult. And that's you, way back there when you got waylaid in your roles, you got your codependency set up, and finding that inner core. So I hope that that'll work real good for you, and God bless you all, and thanks a lot for having me.